Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Saturday, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. This show is all about celebrating artists and their body of worth. I'm so excited about today's guest. He was scheduled to be here originally on my birthday last month, February 11th, but there were a lot of technical difficulties that precluded him from being here. But it's even better that he's here today because this is Cabaret Month. And all this month, I am celebrating those men and women who have made such a difference in the world of cabaret, at least from where I stand. There's so much to celebrate today. There are four S's of music today. Today is Neil Sedaka's birthday. And I had the good pleasure of having Neil Sedaka appear in one of my shows several years ago. My live shows, but that's another show altogether. It's also Mike Stoller's birthday, and I'm actually in negotiations to do a sit-down chat with him as well. And it's also Sammy Kaye's birthday, but there's another Sammy that I am very excited about bringing to all of you today, and that is the one and only Sammy Goldstein. Now, Sammy and I go way back, and we're going to delve into his life, past, present, and future today. But before we begin, Sammy, first of all, thank you for being here. And thank you for making a second attempt to be here. But I want to ask you, how are you doing really in the midst of this crazy world that we find ourselves in right now?
Well, for me, this was not much of a change from my normal life because I have had 40 years of traveling. And every day is its own challenge. On ships, I wake up in different ports and different countries, and I just ad-lib. So, and also on the ships, I'm in a cabin by myself, so I'm alone most of the time. So being in lockdown here in New York for as long as we were and have been, I just adapted. Naturally, I had my good days and bad days emotionally, but it was not a stretch for me to just wing it.
Now, beyond the obvious, the fact that you aren't traveling right now, what is the biggest impact that the pandemic has made on your life and career over the past 10 years? And I mean, obviously, beyond the obvious that all of us in the arts are facing right now.
That's a two-part answer because I was on the verge of cutting back from the ships and basically semi-retiring and just doing, you know, occasional smaller contracts. Mm-hmm. So in a way, this has been a preview into that semi-retirement.
Well, I want to ask you, I mean, because the fact that you have spent a huge portion of your life sitting behind the piano, do you play at home when you're on your own?
Honestly?
Honestly?
No.
Oh,
no.
You don't? Wow.
Well, it's like this. My first club, my first piano bar job was 1977, so that's what, 44 years. And I have been performing anywhere from 3 to 5 hours a night, 6 to 7 nights a week during all those years. And to have a break from it is actually kind of nice, but music is always in my head and in my heart.
Well, do you have any artistic outlets outside of music? Like whether it be painting or writing or flower arranging, anything. Are you doing anything artistically during this time frame that we're in right now?
In those kind of respects, no, I don't have any. My hobby, my biggest hobby in my life has always just been music. So I'm constantly watching performances online and researching. You know, I go on YouTube a lot and just find all sorts of treasures. So being an observer, which has been a lot of fun because, you know, when you're performing so much, you don't get a chance to be in the audience. And it's been a joy to be able to be in the audience with.
I'm guessing that as a piano player on ships, that you're constantly observing everything that's going on around you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I do want to ask with all, what was your calendar like on March 11th of last year? Yesterday marked a year ago that theaters, cabarets, clubs, everything in New York shut down. What did your calendar look like prior to the shutdown?
I had just completed a 5-month contract with Princess Cruises, which is my main cruise line these last 15 years. My only cruise line these last 15 years. And I flew home on the 5th of March. I landed in New York on the 6th of March because I came from South America. And 3 days later, I was at the Gotham Club watching the Bistro Awards front and center. And then that was kind of the beginning of my vacation before my next contract, which wasn't going to be until the late spring. And then, of course, about 4 days after that, lockdown. So my schedule was kind of open, but I had just finished 5 months, 6 or 7 nights a week, and I was, vacationing.
Now, one of the recipients of the Bistro Awards that night was our mutual friend, Sue Mitsuki.
Yes.
You and I have known each other a long, long, long time. But it was Sue that actually said, Richard, you should bring Sammy on because we have another mutual friend, Nancy Soleil, who's been sitting almost in the same spot that you're in right now. And Nancy also has made a lifetime of performing on cruise ships, excluding the pandemic, of course. How many years altogether would you say that you've been performing in, if you'll pardon the expression, in the cruise industry?
Wow. I would say that my first 20 years, I was much more in the piano lounges and the clubs. And just doing sporadic ships here and there. I would say about 50-50. I'd say I've spent probably 20 years collectively on ships and 20 years collectively in clubs.
Now, what is the biggest change that you've seen in the industry since you first started? And out of the changes that you've seen, what are the ones that you've enjoyed the most? And what are the changes that you actually have resisted the most?
Wow. Number one, security. When I first started, my first ship was 1982. And, if I had a friend in port, I could bring him on for a visit, to have a meal, whatever, onto the ship. And I'm trying to think, there was just much more freedom then. All through the 80s and into the 90s.
Are you saying that you could pick somebody up at a port and bring them on ship?
Yes.
I'm joking.
Well, not pick. Well, you're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm not. No. That's how gossip gets started.
I love gossip. Okay. I spread it as often as I can. No.
Oh, good for you.
After 9/11, security became, intense, and a lot of the freedoms were squashed. One thing that was interesting was prior to 9/11, passengers and crew members could mingle a lot more. After 9/11, it became stricter and stricter to where it's very discouraged with most of the crew. Entertainers is okay to mingle with passengers, but...
So it's not the love boat?
No, and as a matter of fact, in the last number of years, if a passenger is caught in a crew cabin or if a crew member is caught in a passenger cabin, the crew member is dismissed the next day or in the next port permanently. So it's very strict. The passenger is not, you know, punished, but the crew member is.
Now, you've traveled all over the world, but you're actually born in Paris. Am I correct?
I was born and raised in Paris, Tennessee.
Paris, Tennessee. I want to go back to Paris, Tennessee, where it all began for you. So I want to know a little bit about your parents. Do you have brothers and sisters?
One brother, one sister, and...
And where do you fit in?
Wait a minute. 8 stepbrothers and stepsisters.
8?
Yes. My father was married 3 times, and he survived my mother and my first stepmother, and so collectively they're 8 of the stepkids. Yeah, it was...
How do you plan your holidays with something with that?
Well, these days, the Goldstein portion, we don't really do reunion stuff with the other 2 families as much. A little bit, but not, you know, so it's still pretty much just the Goldstein side.
And with you, I mean, let's go back. I do this with a lot of my interviews. I like to go back to the 5-year-old you. What was the 5-year-old? Yes, there it is. And I'm drinking out of my Richard Skipper mug as well.
Oh, very good. Yes.
So when you were 5 years old, what was your family like? Life like? Did you have music playing in your home? You know, I talk about this often in my own, in other shows, but I'm a product of 1960s and 70s television. I know I'm a lot older than you are. But I grew up with where television was a constant in our home. The hi-fi was a piece of furniture in our living room, and we listened to albums. My mom, who I blame for all of this, brought me my first Judy Garland album, my first Liza Minnelli album. Happy birthday, Liza. What was the entertainment scene like in your household as a 5-year-old kid?
You know, my father was Mr. Businessman, traditional family man, and he was always working. And, you know, there was not any influence from him. But my mother was the social part, portion of that, of my parents. And when I was a little boy, probably around 5 or 6, let me see. No, I had to be, I was 6 years old. They got the double record album of Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall. And I did not realize that the voice on that album was the same person in The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. But I listened to that album constantly. I was smitten. And I grew up that, you know, then they also had soundtracks to movies and Broadway shows and, of course, Frank Sinatra and John mm-hmm. Mathis. But it was my mother. She was the artistic side, even though she didn't sing or play an instrument. Mm-hmm. She appreciated it.
So when you were listening to this music, you started in school. Were you exposed to the arts in school? Did you have an arts and education program starting with grammar school and then beyond?
Give me about an hour to think back that far. Oh, my goodness. And by the way, I think I'm older than you. We'll have to have a bet on that.
Okay, we'll talk about that later.
Okay, off camera.
Off camera.
I remember in... My mother passed away when I was 8 years old, and I seriously don't remember much at all of those 8 years. It's like I blocked it, so I don't remember being involved in anything musically. I do remember one thing, and I talk about this on the ships. when I was five and in kindergarten, my hometown had an annual concert at the city auditorium, and all the townspeople came, and they got representatives from the kindergarten, from grade school, high school, to put on a big show just one night every year for all the townsfolk. And I was chosen that year as a representative for my kindergarten class, and I was given a song, "Oh, You Beautiful Doll," to learn. Now, I didn't play piano then, so that I stood on a stage. It was about 600 people. It seated about 600 people, so it was a big stage. And in front of a microphone, the pianist was down on the floor of the auditorium, and I was up there all alone. And they, at rehearsal, they could tell I was scared, so they put my kindergarten sweetheart next to me. Candy Cole is her name, and she's still in Paris. I always joke, she's still in Paris with nine kids. And
they good for her. But you can't be implicated.
No, I can't be implicated. Thank you. And they said, sing to Candy, it'll calm you down. And at the end of the song, kiss you in the cheek. And it did calm me down, and it went well. And at the end, I kissed her on the cheek. I think that was my first public kiss. Anyway, that was my first exposure to performing, and I loved it, but I was petrified. And I don't remember doing anything again until junior high school choir.
Mm-hmm.
Then once I got in choir, and then subsequently the high school theater and the community theater, it was just night and day.
Now, I want to go back, you know, forgive me for going here for a moment, but when your mom passed away, how long after your mom passing away did your father remarry? And obviously, with a new dynamic of a family, what were some of the big changes in your life? And did your family move to another home, or did she move into your home?
The dynamic changed incredibly. It was a year and a half later that my father remarried. My parents had just built a house out in the country about 2 years earlier, and it was a double house. So the main house with a two-car outdoor garage connecting to a small house, and my mother's parents, my grandparents, lived in the small house. When my father remarried, there was conflict. My mother was an only child, and he asked my grandparents to move. And it was not a happy scenario during those years.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, well, I won't tell you what year. But we moved 2 years later. Oh, and of course, my stepmother and her family had moved into our house.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we moved 2 years later to Alabama. My father took over a store down there. He was in the clothing business. And he took over a store down there. And that's when my life seemed to really start with performing, because that was where I found the choir and the. I think I've gotten far away from your original question. What was
it? No. I mean, I'm really interested in the trajectory of where you're taking us, because I want to know, was a piano a piece of, I mean, was there a piano in your household?
Okay. When I was probably six, my mother bought a piano for my brother, sister, and me, and put us in piano lessons, and we all quit within a few months. None of us liked it, or liked the lessons. And it sat as a piece of furniture. In high school, I remember I would pick out melodies because I could read individual notes. You know, I retained that much. So with one finger, I would pick out melodies to teach myself songs for the choir and the theater and stuff. And I put together one song with both hands with the sheet music, very simple. And that was the only thing I could play until probably my third year of college, where I started really, retraining myself.
Now, you started doing theater. I know that you were Og in Finian's Rainbow, and you were model in Fiddler on the Roof. You started doing theater. Was this an outlet through high school, or was there a community theater that you actually went to and started auditioning? And what was the impetus to get you to go and audition for your first show?
My first theater was high school. We had the choir director also directed the theater department in high school in Alabama. And this is Anniston, Alabama, by the way. Mm-hmm. I was just in everything. I don't remember what the first show even was, but we were doing, all the traditional high school things, Rodgers and Hammerstein, and eventually The Music Man, and that whole genre. At the same time, we got, I don't know if you know the name Martin Platt.
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay. He, right out of Carnegie Mellon, was hired to be our community theater director.
Wow. Wow.
And his first show at the community theater, which was in the old high school auditorium, was Leave It to Jane. And at that time, it's a high school show, or college, I can't remember now. But anyway, it's a collegiate show. And a lot of the high school kids were cast in it. My father did not approve. He thought it was only going to be adults. He refused to let me be in it. On the opening night, he let me go to the theater, and I pulled the curtain. And after he picked me up that night, he had a change of heart. And he said, I realize now the kids are involved, and you can be in whatever you want. And from that point on, I was in every show at the community theater, dramas, musicals, everything, as well as the high school musicals. And that just blossomed, after that.
I want to ask you, but what was the reasoning behind your father not wanting you to do theater with just adults?
He was extremely conservative when it came to kids, mm-hmm. us kids. Once I graduated high school, went off to college, he became a whole new person and was my biggest fan, all the rest of my life. We had a super relationship from that point on, but all the way growing up, he was raised in a very split family. His parents immigrated from Ukraine. His father never learned English. His mother died young, and his siblings were all put in an orphanage. So he just had a conservative mindset, and it just took him longer than most to finally break out of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, right after high school, where did you go to college?
2 years, University of Alabama, 1 year at Memphis State University.
And at what point did you decide that you wanted to pursue this as a career?
You mean theater or club?
Theater.
Okay. When my father took me to college, he drove me over, and I'm sitting on my bed in my dorm, and I said right then, okay, I'm going to do college, and I'm going to spend 3 years in LA and 3 years in New York and see which coast is best and pursue theater. And I stuck to that plan. I never intended to get into nightclub work.
Now, that's a very interesting thing that you say, because a lot of people either choose between one or the other. And you decided that you were going to go to both. Did you flip a coin to decide which one you were going to go to first?
Oh, now that's interesting. And I want to eventually answer what happened with the I was pursuing theater and music at the same time, and after several years it just became too much and I had to choose, and I chose what I was making my living at, which was music in piano lounges.
Were you getting opportunities in Alabama to play a piano in lounges and other areas? Were you making money before you made the move to Los Angeles?
No, actually, when I transferred for my third year of college from Alabama to Tennessee, that summer before my third year started, I wandered into a piano bar because I'd seen an ad in a magazine with this lady's picture, and I just said, "Ooh, she looks fun. I'm going to go see her." And I'd never even been in a bar. Mm-hmm. And that first night, I was so scared to even go in. I sat outside and just listened. But eventually I, you know, went in and I just stood up. She always had open mic. And so I stood up and sang with her like everybody else did. Mm-hmm. And then one night she said, "I'm going on a break. And if anybody wants to sit in and play the piano, help yourself." And that one song that I told you I learned in high school, I got up there, The Sound of Music, and I played it. And she comes back from her break and sees me playing. And she said, "I didn't know you played piano." I said, "I don't. She said, "From now on, you're going to learn to play for yourself. I'm never playing for you again. You're going to learn both piano and singing together so you can make a living." And that was my push.
Do you think if that moment had not happened that everything would have been different for you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think of these pivotal moments in our life where a light bulb goes off or a door opens and you're on this path. So you did make the decision that you were going to go to Los Angeles first.
Yes.
So now that's where we are in the story. Why Los Angeles with the work that you were pursuing?
When I'm trying to think of the timeline here. I was home to Paris, Tennessee. My parents had moved back after my second year of college. And one of my friends in Paris, another name you'll probably know, Cherry Jones.
Yes.
She's a Paris, Tennessee girl. And as a matter of fact, her father had a flower shop on one side of the court square, and right across was my father's clothing store. So our families were close. Anyway, I was over at her house one time that summer, and she had the album to A Chorus Line, and she played it for me, and I was, of course, blown away. And by the time I got ready to move to out of college
I have the response that I'm having to you, because so many of us of a certain age, A Chorus Line comes out and it lands like a ton of bricks on our heads in terms of really wanting to go after this as a real career. Did you have that feeling as well?
I didn't relate to the show and for dancing, mm-hmm. but the stories.
The stories.
And the singing, but the stories, it blew me away to see the human side of performers. And knowing that these were based on real stories.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got ready to get out of college, I said, the New York company of A Chorus Line had transferred to Los Angeles, to the Schubert Theater out there. And I so wanted to see the original company. That was the reason I moved to LA first, just so I could see the original company. And I ended up seeing the show, between L.A. and then later New York, 15 times.
Wow. And did you know anyone when you went to Los Angeles?
I had a friend of a lady in the piano bar Mary Jane was the piano bar entertainer I'm talking about. Mary Jane, I knew a friend of one of her customers, and I had a high school friend I knew of her brother, and that was it.
So where did you first stay when you got to Los Angeles? And what was the experience like moving? I'm sure it was a very different experience for you, moving from Tennessee to L.A. So where did you stay and how did you get acclimated in L.A.?
I drove out in my old 63 Chevy Impala and just got in it, loaded my stuff and drove cross country. I think I had something like $300 in my pocket. And my first plan, the friend of the piano bar customer let me stay at her house for about a week when I first got there. During that week, I went to every restaurant looking for a waiter job, every hotel looking for a desk clerk job, and just dead-ended everywhere. One of the friends of that lady suggested this piano bar. He said, there's a lady playing there and you should go there and tell them you heard they're looking for an entertainer. And I said, are they? She said, no, just tell them that you heard about it. So I walked in and I said, I heard you're looking for an entertainer. And this is in the daytime. It was just the bartender. And he said, let me call the owner. And they had me play a couple songs and they hired me. And I'm sad to say they fired the lady that played five nights a week and gave me five nights a week.
But what was that about? I mean, what was it that she didn't bring to the table that you were bringing to the table?
Apparently, from what they told me, she, you know, she could play and she could sing, but she had no personality. And I was brand new at playing. So I had only been playing for about a year at that point, you know, really had dived into it. But I was, you know, I guess they just saw that I could talk and relate and stuff. They took a chance on me and it was utter success from the first night. It just worked. Then I found an apartment, during that week. I just drove all around the city and I found one. Turns out it was three blocks from the piano lounge. I didn't even know that. It just came together.
Yeah, so that was convenient. But, and then did you start auditioning for film and television right away? And I'm assuming that you auditioned for film and television as opposed to live theater.
Correct. In my 3 years in L.A., TV, film, commercials. I didn't have any great success, but, you know, I got little bits here and there.
Well, before you go any further, I want to say just a few weeks ago, I was channel surfing, and I see an episode of Columbo. And I said to Danny, that looks like Sammy Goldstein. And sure enough, it was you. It's very interesting, and you also did a Murder, She Wrote, where you were also a piano player. How did was it just special skills on your resume that got you those jobs? Well, I mean, how did those come about?
I pursued constantly, you know, the acting jobs. And again, the casting director for Murder, She Wrote happened to walk into a piano bar one night where I was performing, and he saw me performing. They needed an actor who could sing and play for this part. Mm-hmm. And he apparently went to the, what's the old book where you have all the actors' pictures? Ross Report, yeah, something like that. And he found me and I had an agent. So he called my agent and booked me. He didn't even audition me. He just booked me straight from the piano bar performance. And then later that led by word of mouth to the Columbo thing, which was also, singing and playing. And then the Trials of Rosie O'Neill. Remember the Sharon Gless?
Yes, yes.
So that was another one where they needed an actor who sang and played. And
now, were you able to break into the union through these jobs?
Oh, yes. SAG-AFTRA, when I moved to New York, of course, I got an industrial show. And got my equity card. So I got all my union.
You got all the union cards. But before you come to how long you were in LA for 2 years? I mean, obviously you're working. Three years. You're working. You're getting bit parts here and there. What was the deciding factor for you to move to New York at this point?
Well, that was when I was on my bed in my dorm room. That's what I said then. I'm going to say 3 years in LA, or 3 years in one, 3 years in the other, and I just stuck to that. So at the end of 3 years in LA, I just said it's time, and I had no fear, you know.
No. None of us did when we were younger. But how did the move to New York take place?
I had done some summer stock theater, the Jenny Wiley Summer Music Theater in Prestonsburg.
I know it, yes.
Okay. That was my first professional theater job. We did 1776 in 1976. We did South Pacific and Grass Harp, which was so wonderful. Anyway, one of the actors, and Showboat, one of the actors in that company lived in New York. And when I got ready to move, he said he needed a roommate. He had a two-bedroom Brooklyn apartment. So that's I moved into an actual apartment that time.
So when you came to New York, were there any survival jobs, or did you start getting work in the piano bars right away? Because at about the time that you came to New York, there were a lot more piano bars than there are now. So did you have a lot of opportunity waiting for you when you got here?
Yes, I immediately got out of, you know, coming to Manhattan every night and just, what's the word, pound the pavement. And went into every club that I could find that had a piano. And I landed a job within a week. I just never stopped. You know, I worked a bunch of different clubs and eventually had a home club. You remember the Gaslight Club?
Of course I do. Yes.
Okay. I did a bunch of the piano bars for the first, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. And then my father was responsible. He knew a guy from Anniston, Alabama, who was a pianist. He didn't sing, but he worked in a club on the East Side, just instrumentals all the time. He introduced him to me over the phone, and that guy introduced me to an agent who got me into the Gaslight Club. So, you know, so my father actually got me my first big job, which was just great, you know.
And what was it? What was your schedule like at that point? And were you able to make a lot of money on tips?
At the Gaslight Club, yes. It was a high roller. It was like the Playboy Club. You know, it was nothing for people to, you know, this is many years ago. It's nothing for them to throw 20s and 50s in the tip jar. So, my time there, it was wonderful financially, but also I was forced into playing and singing. Excuse me. I was forced into playing piano for the singing waitresses because they were all like in the bunny type outfits. And they did the bunny outfits before the Playboy Club did. But their requirement was they had to sing. And I have never been an accompanist. I've never had that talent, the ear for it. I still to this day can't just change keys by ear, but that pushed me into learning some about accompanying. And so it was good musically, it was good financially. And I met Tiny Tim came in one night and sang, got up and sang, and asked me later if I would go on the road to be his musical director, which is like.
And did you?
No, I thought, I can't. I'll miss out on some big opportunity here.
He was quite a character. I did a benefit with him many years ago. Wow. Many years ago.
He was wonderful. I so regret that I didn't take him up on it. You know, I just was young and dumb.
One of the things that started happening at this time, I want to go back for a moment because you said early on that you really made the decision that you wanted to work in the world of piano bar, lounges, playing the piano. There are so many great artists in New York, and many of them you and I both know, who got so caught up in the world of nightlife in New York. And I worked at Marie's Crisis for many years. And when you're doing a job like that, it's virtually impossible to get up the next morning, go to auditions, and to really pursue a career outside the work that you're doing in the piano bar. Did you truly make a conscious choice that you were not going to pursue a career as an actor? And was it an easy choice for you to make, letting go of that aspect of who you are?
The 3 years that I was in New York then, I pursued every theater audition every morning. But there were, you know, always, as you know, the guys go early at 10, the women go later at 1. So I would finish the piano lounges and just be sung out, also smoky lounges. Just I would go in these auditions, and for 3 years, I think I had like maybe 3 callbacks. It was just horrible, but I kept pursuing it. At the end of 3 years, I have had good success with the clubs, and I got my first cruise ship, and I got my, you know, that industrial tour, which I mentioned, but I was burnt out. And at the end of that 3 years, I decided to move back to LA, give up, pursue. That's when I said, I can't do both. And that was the deciding factor of not audition for theater anymore and just stick to clubs. And I spent 10 years in LA, absolutely loved it. And that's when I got the TV shows. And that's when I started.
You started playing for a lot of celebrity clients. Barbara Walters, David Geffen, are just two that come to mind. How did those begin to happen? Was it word of mouth? Or how do you don't actually pursue those kind of jobs?
No. When I was in those early years in LA in the late 70s, I just gave away the years now. I worked in a club. It was my last club before I moved to New York that first time. And the owners, they divorced. The wife moved to Washington, D.C. and went to work at the White House as a secretary. And she recommended me to someone to do Barbara Walters' party, a party of hers at her home in New York. And so it was just, she got me that job, just recommended me. And from there, let's see, that was about 84, somewhere in the early 80s. I ended up doing like, I think, 4 parties for Barbara Walters at her home. Oh my gosh. Little dinner parties, 10 people, 12 people, but the A-list, you know. And word of mouth. I never pursued it. It was just recommendations. And I also met this couple. The husband was president of NBC daytime television, and his wife was a painter. And they started recommending me to all their friends, and huge number of parties just through that one couple. So, you know, as you know, word of mouth and recommendations.
And then the cruise ship business. I mean, how did that begin to happen for you? And your first audition, was it intimidating for you to go in and audition for this? Or was you just treated it like any other job you were auditioning for?
I didn't audition. I wrote letters to all the cruise lines in the late 70s up until 82. For 5 years, and I always kept getting the same response: we can't hire you until you've had experience on ships. So I
I said, which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yes. So one day I'm in my apartment in New York, this is 82, and I get a phone call, and it's the entertainment director for a cruise line, in Florida, and he said, someone gave me your name. We have an emergency. We have a ship coming into New York tomorrow. The entertainer's sick. Can you hop on? It'll be for 2 weeks.
And the next day.
What?
It's the next day that you're going to start this.
The next day. I dropped everything. Everything.
So,
just
so, Sammy, those voodoo dolls that you had for so many years actually came into practice at this point. So, no, the next day. I mean, where was the ship going to sail to?
It was New York to the Bahamas, on to Florida. It was a ship. They had two ships, and the basement of the ships held 400 cars. And so people would take their cars from New York, have a vacation in the Bahamas for a couple of days, and then come to Florida and drive off, or vice versa. Great idea. And I was able to be back every 2 weeks to New York and check my mail and stuff. The 2 weeks turned into 6 months. It was the old phrase, okay, the fish to water, okay?
And I mean, and did you acclimate yourself right away to this? Did you say, this, I love doing this? I know that for years you performed on the cruise ships. It was very rare that we would ever see you in New York or LA for that matter, because you were sailing the seas, but you loved it.
I immediately loved it. The piano lounge on that first ship, it was packed every night. Just it solidified me as an entertainer. And of course, people from around the world. So I got to, you know, started getting into other languages as well. And, but the excitement on a ship in a lounge is the best. Mm-hmm. I've rarely been in a lounge on land that matched that excitement.
How much control do you have when you're working in a lounge on a ship? Do you bring your own repertoire to the table, or do they decide what they want you to do?
But that's interesting, because in the clubs in New York, you need to be a pianist who can accompany the singing waiters and singing mm-hmm. waitresses and bartenders and the audience. On ships, you're the entertainer. And since I was not a good accompanist, that's what made it work so well, is that I could just do my thing. Ships gave me 100% flexibility to do whatever I did. Mm-hmm. Just do what you do best. It's your room. That was the kind of the mantra.
Did you feel like you were holding court every night, that it was your party, that these were your guests, and you were in control of what was going on?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, Mary Jane, that wonderful lady that got me started, she said, always treat your lounge like it's your living room, and these are your friends and family. And that's the mindset I had. And so every night, I don't want to say hold court, but it was just like, welcome to my living room.
But you know, if I can say something, I mean, when I first came to New York, almost every single piano bar or cabaret room that did this worked from that mindset. I will use Dick Gallagher as an example. I mean, when Dick Gallagher was sitting at the piano playing, it was a party. He would see people in the audience that he knew that he could get up to sing. He would bring them up. I used to go to a place called the Five Oaks. Marie Blake, who used to sit and play the piano, you knew Marie. She would do the same every single room. And then there was a shift. And when I feel that when the piano bar lounges that were in the cabaret rooms began to compete with the shows that were going on in the back, it became about the wait staff that was performing there. With all due respect to what they do, I'm talking about another era in which every single person in that room was part of the festivities. And then it became a show, and the people that are sitting in the audience are just an audience. It's a different feel.
Yeah. When I moved back to LA after my first 3 years in New York, it was still the kind of atmosphere to where you had one person do five nights a week, the main person, and you had something else on the weekends. And over those next 10 years, it shifted, yes, and they started having a different person every night at the piano. Seven people, seven nights. So suddenly, as an entertainer, if you want to work six nights a week, you're working one night each in six different clubs. No one knew where to find you. It was hard to do that. And yeah, it became out of date to have an entertainer who basically this was their home.
Oh, I want to tell you, I miss it. I miss what that world was like. Our dear friend Annie Hughes came to New York a few years ago, and she wanted to go to one of our old haunts. And I said, it's not the same. She was practically in tears when we left about how much it had changed since we went there. One thing that I do want to talk about. Go ahead.
Annie Hughes was a gaslight girl when I was playing and singing there in 1980.
Wow.
We still flash back to those days.
I've seen some of the pictures from those days. Yes. But I do want to, you know, talk about one thing before we do run out of time. And that is, this is Cabaret Month. And I want to talk about you finally getting up from, finally, I don't mean to go that route, but you got up from behind the piano and you put your own show together where you were just singing to the audience and you won the Mac Award for debut performance. What was the deciding factor that got you to say, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to go out there and do it as opposed to sitting back here and doing it? And how did you decide who was going to play for you?
Wow. In the mid-90s, before I moved back to New York again in 96, I did the Cabaret Symposium in Connecticut. Ellie Ellsworth was directing at the time. Margaret Whiting was a teacher. I think Julie Wilson was a teacher. It was just, and I signed up for, auditioned for it and got in. And they told me there, first of all, slow down. I always played and sang too fast. Mm-hmm. And they encouraged me to stand up. That's where I started getting that bug. It just evolved from there. I never sang with other musicians as a rule. And there was a freedom there. It was scary as hell. But I think it was 98. I did my first show as a stand-up singer. And I don't remember who recommended me to him or him to me, but Barry Levitt.
Wow. Wow.
Did my first show, my first CD. I miss him so much, as the whole community does.
Yes. But fortunately and unfortunately, I say fortunately because I was there for him, but I was with him when he passed away. Yeah. And which we'll talk about at another time. I tear up thinking about that. When you got up to sing, were you already a member of MAC, the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs, for those who don't know, or did you become a member because of the road that you were now on?
I think I had joined right when I moved back to New York in 96. I was already a member, but not for maybe a couple of years. In LA, I loved the idea of the MAC Awards and the MAC community. And, I jumped on it when I got to New York. I also had been invited, somehow was recommended to Donald Smith. So I when I was still in LA in the mid 90s, he brought me to New York to perform at the Cabaret Convention at Town Hall. And yeah, I dove in when I got here.
And what was the experience like for you when you found out that you'd been nominated for a MAC Award?
I was beside myself because I had only had one nomination for any award in my entire life, and that was in community theater during high school. One time, so it was like, oh, Sally Field, they like me. They really like me. And then when I actually won the award, I was, yeah, blown away. Blown away. Barbara Cook presented my award to me.
Wow.
With Wally Hartley.
Wow. Well, Tom Wopat presented my first MAC Award to me. So that was great. I do want to come full circle. We are doing this in the midst of COVID's not over. Pandemic's not over. Have you been vaccinated yet?
Yes, I got my second shot of over a month ago.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And so what's next for you when we are able to go back to work?
Well, I had wanted to do one more big contract with Princess, like a good 5 or 6 month contract. And I'm just waiting till they're sailing. It's looking more like the end of the year now. Mm-hmm. They were going to do the Alaska season, but then there were problems with Canada allowing ships until next February, U.S. ships. And so it may be the end of the year, top of next year. And I'm just patiently waiting.
Well, that's what we all have to do.
I do have one private party lined up for May 15th.
So for you, that's great. Yeah. Socially distanced, of course.
Oh, yes. I guess the same couples party last August, and masked, and the people were masked, and it worked beautifully.
That's great. Well, Sammy, I love you. I have loved you since I first met you 125 years ago when you and I were both two. You know, we both have come through many changes in this business together. I thank you for being here. And I want to thank everyone else for being here. This is the first time that we have done this show exclusively through YouTube as a live event. If you are watching this on YouTube right now, please leave a comment on YouTube so that both Sammy and I know what your thoughts are about the show. And also, please click on the subscribe button. Please subscribe to this channel. I want to let everyone know if you're around tomorrow afternoon, and I'm so excited about this, 1970s child star Sparky Marcus. Sammy, look at that face. Do you recognize him?
No.
He was on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. He was on the Nancy Walker show. He was on Soap. He did everything. But when he became a teenager, he left the business. And I will be his first interview in 37 years.
Wow.
So we're going to talk about that era of show business and everything. So I'm very excited that I'm going to be doing this tomorrow. So if you can all tune in tomorrow night, at 5 o'clock, please do so. I want to remind everybody, set your clocks ahead tonight. We're going to lose an hour when we all go to bed tonight.
Really?
Yes, you know, so set your clocks ahead. And I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list, and the fourth name that pops up, reach out to that person and let them know what they mean to you. Not an email, not a text message, not a private inbox message, but a phone call. Let them know what they mean to you. As our dear friend David Friedman says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And you never know what someone else is going through, especially now. Reach out. And Sammy, I want to give you the final word. Anything that you want to talk about that we talked about today that you want to expound upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to everyone right now. And I want you to come back sometime. Promise me.
I promise. I'd love to. I've had a ball today. So thank you. And thanks to everybody who is actually watching us live. I have, this is a plug. I have not updated my website in ages because of the pandemic, but there's a page on there for my two CDs, which are only available digitally, iTunes and things like that. And so if anybody wants a little music, just check the CD page of my website. There's a schedule page, which I'll update it as soon as I have any contracts with the ships. And but it's been a ride, you know, when you get to be our age, like Richard and me, and you know, when we talk about doing this, I started thinking back the last 40 something years, and oh, so many things I'd not thought about in forever came to mind. And it's good to reach back and check the attic and the basement and see where your life has evolved and how it's evolved and who you've met and gotten to know and who you've gotten to love and everything. So, yeah.
Thank you. Love you, Sam. Goodbye, everyone. Make it a better tomorrow. Good night.